Welcome to part two of our interview with Matthew Sweeney about the ghosts of World War II, objects and things, keepsakes. A lot of folks have, awards. I'm going to use incorrect terminology trying to describe these things, but things mm-hmm. that you know were passed down, in the military, in the army, through service, for what sure. they've done. And somebody's holding on to it because that was their grandfather's, that was their mm-hmm. father's or whatnot. How often did you find that objects held something attached to them?
I'm trying to think if I found any where they played key roles, but what could happen is they might be these haunted objects, but it actually could be they might blame the manifestations on something else. But sure. what I do know is that in the Soviet Union, and just a little historical check here, the Eastern Front was just incredibly brutal. I don't know what the casualty figures are for the Russian and the German casualties in that front, but they must have been, orders of magnitude larger than what the Allies faced in Western Europe. In any event, the battles were so frequent, munitions and tanks and equipment destroyed, splattered everywhere throughout the Eastern Front, Russia and in Eastern Europe. And there was so much of it that it gave rise to what they call I picked this story up from Pravda. It's called black archaeologists. And these are people who go out and try to find those very objects that you were talking about, daggers, guns, ammunition boxes, pieces of equipment, and then they sell that on the black market. And a lot of those folks have come forward to talk about some of the creepy things that they have seen and witnessed during these expeditions. So it could make you wonder whether it's the area, because there was such great conflict there and a lot of deaths and injuries and tragedies in those areas, or whether it's tied to some of these objects.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, what exactly would trigger some of those things and what objects things would be attached to. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have something, like a gun or something of that nature, if, you're fighting for your life, you're relying on this object to essentially save your life and get you through. I would think that there could be so much energy just put onto that thing that itself would be just a magnet for residual type energy.
Well, yeah, and this never made it to the book because it's more of a personal story, but I had a friend who was he collected war memorabilia from all the different wars, and he claimed that if he could try on a ring, he would know whether it was fake or not because it would have this kind of buzz to it. So that's one of those kinds of stories that you hear from, people in that circle, from that kind of black archaeologist story, that there's something about these objects that have a kind of a presence, maybe contain some of the evil or the tragedy that of that time.
In your research and compiling stories from both in America and from overseas, how does it differ as far as how people talk about the spirits and just the very topic of ghosts of World War II?
That's an intriguing question. And I will say that no stories moved me more than some of the stories that came out of the Pacific theater, especially when concerning the Japanese soldiers. And I wonder, and I don't know whether, I've really didn't research it this deeply, but I wonder whether it doesn't have something to do with the ancestral worship of the Japanese. That seems to be pretty embedded in that culture. And I can give you a couple examples there's a story that I got from a Japanese newspaper, and this comes from a Japanese military contractor who works in Iwo Jima but flies back and forth to Japan quite a bit. And he told the reporter that he would frequently, on the night before his flight took off from Iwo Jima, he would get a knock at the door. And he initially didn't know really what was going on, but then assumed that it was the spirits of these Japanese soldiers who were killed. Iwo Jima, just a little background, was just a nest of caves and tunnels, and the Japanese fought pretty much to the last man on that island. A lot of those soldiers were buried alive or were killed with burned alive in those fortifications. So his idea was that they would come to his door because they wanted to go back to the mainland. And eventually he got to the place where he would open up the door and say, you know, I'm leaving at 6, come on along. But there are a lot of those types of stories in the South Pacific. Makes me think that there's something to this idea of ancestral worship, and almost a longing to go back, go back to Japan, go back home. Those stories crop up there. As far as the United States, and I can't really say that there's a pattern.
No, I just didn't know. As far as the acceptance of the concept of ghosts, it seems to be a little greater overseas. In many countries, it's more so like it's a way of life. We've obviously been established much longer than we have in the States. So sometimes having your household ghost in parts of Europe is just kind of a normal thing. And in the U.S., it's getting more and more of an acceptable topic and an accepted thought process. But I just wonder if it has the same sort of credence or thought process that we have over here.
Yeah, it seems to me that I would say the Japanese stories really speak to what you're talking about. There's an acceptance. I mean, if someone was knocking at my door at 3 o'clock in the morning, I probably wouldn't instantly go to, oh, that's probably a soldier who wants to go back home.
Sure.
You know, I would probably think it was some jerk kid who's, messing with me. But that certainly came up in that story. There's some other really very sad stories that come out of Okinawa too, that I think represents another aspect of maybe Japanese culture, or maybe hopefully just everybody should learn something from this. But there is a story of in Okinawa, again, another island invaded by the Americans. And prior to that invasion, the Japanese military had told the civilians that if the Americans land, they're going to, kill you, rape you, and torture you. And so I think what they tried to get the civilians to do was to resist the Americans in a guerrilla-style fashion. But in fact, when the Americans landed, they were horrified when they would see these civilians run to the cliffs and jump off. Mm-hmm. And there is a peace museum located near one of the sites where these mass suicides occurred. And several people have talked about walking in the fields near the museum, and the first thing they hear is what sounds to be pounding footsteps coming behind them. Then they feel this rush of wind past them, and then they hear screams and what sounds like people falling off the cliffs. So that's a case too of those ghost stories. Really, for me, serve a mythological purpose. That's really a warning and a cautionary tale about just how terrible war can be. So one of the things you kind of have to be careful about when you're writing these things, and by careful, I mean if you want to think about these stories on a different level, I mean you can accept them as they are, as these, interesting stories or spooky stories, but there's another level and there's another layer to these stories about what they're telling us, what they're telling the storyteller, and what the storyteller is trying to get across. And I think those stories that occur in the South Pacific seem less about the conflict and more about the lesson, more about you know, being away from home and never getting home, never making it back home.
Sure.
Your life is, as you know, it has been destroyed and you'll never get it back. Or, you know, these tales of these unfortunate civilians who killed themselves because they thought, you know, their lives were over. These are incredibly profound, you know, mythological statements, I think.
Yeah, and these are tales of real life. I mean, it's not even, you know, we oftentimes talk about ghosts for entertainment, and most of the time you listen to the shows for entertainment. But the thing is, we're talking about, you know, such a tragic point in history, and the toll that it had on human life, and those that lived through it, the psychological toll that it took on them. I mean, it's no wonder that there's so much activity around this time. And we see that throughout history, wherever there is a lot of tragic conflict and things of that nature, and very high, you know, emotional volume, these sort of things happen. We often talk about haunted houses. We talk about haunted places, haunted, you know, ships, objects, things of that nature. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the machinery itself that people have seen as ghostly objects. I want to hear about haunted tanks, haunted aircraft. What are some of those stories that people report to this day?
Sure. And this is a kind of a fascinating part of the book for me, because this is one of these stories that makes me an open-minded skeptic. And prior to writing this book, years and years ago, I was just a kid. My mom had told me this story about how every Saturday morning, she and my dad would wake up early and they would take a little walk around the block. And, you know, I live in a small town, and they would walk maybe a mile or come back. And she said that they walked off the porch, took a few steps, looked down the alley, and in the air about what she would say would be about 100, 200 feet off the ground was this massive plane that was flying silently, flew silently over both of them, and they both saw it. My dad was always much more of a skeptic than me, and it was a semi-foggy morning. The plane goes over them. My mom could even say that she saw the cockpit light on. It banks up and disappears into the fog. And that was always called, you know, Judy's ghost plane, we used to call it. And it was a kind of a famous piece of family folklore that was passed around. And I loved that story. And I started to think about, as I was writing this book, you know, there was a lot of planes in World War II. That was really the first war where they played such a massive role. And so I thought, I wonder if there are any ghost planes. And then I thought, where would one see a ghost plane? And so I thought England was kind of the aircraft carrier for the Allies. So maybe it would be there. And not only did I find, you know, one or two ghost plane accounts, but apparently over the years since World War II, there have been a series of what they call ghost plane flaps, where people have seen multiple accounts or have multiple accounts of seeing what looks like World War II planes in the air. And one happened pretty recently. I think one happened in the 80s, and there was one in the early 2000s. And I believe, as I was just finishing up this book, what normally happens is, as soon as you go to press, you find the coolest story ever and you can't include it in the book. But I do believe there was another kind of World War II ghost plane flap. And the one story that I can remember is that there was a couple driving down, I think it was the A6, a highway in what's the area is called Dark Peak. And from what I gather, it's almost like England's Bermuda Triangle. There have been so many plane crashes, especially during World War II. Anyway, these people look up and they see this plane coming to them, towards them. They recognize it as an older plane because it has props. It's flying so low, they think it's going to crash. It goes overhead, and as I recall the story, they don't hear anything. It's pretty silent. Flies over, they're expecting to hear a crash. They don't hear anything. They call, I think, the cops and the reporters, and the police said that they had several of those calls that came in stating that they saw this World War II bomber. You know, the skeptic in me was looking for skeptical accounts. And there are some people who say, well, it was probably going to an air show. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, when you look into it, there wasn't any air show during that time period. And the other peculiar thing about it was, and there were no military aircraft in the area, apparently. And the really peculiar thing for me was that these sightings were not registered in what would be more or less a straight line. They had been all over the place. So this plane must have been zigzagging all over England to get this number of people, which doesn't seem to be what you would consider an aircraft, especially that big and that expensive, doing it at that time. So that was a ghost plane story. And again, quite a few of those. These black archaeologists that I was talking about earlier, one of these teams was in Russia, near a battlefield, and they had camped that night. And they said they woke up and they could hear the clanking of treads. And they went to try to, they waited till the next morning, and they actually found fresh tread tracks near where they were camping. So they thought that maybe this was the ghost of some, you know, ghost tank, some Russian ghost tank going, or Panzer going through the forest at that time.
That's amazing. I mean, just to have these objects, these massive pieces of machinery, mm-hmm. that you're able to, that people are encountering and seeing. What I think would be the strangest thing to me is if you're out there and you're experiencing this, is the silence of them, where quite often people see them and it's as clear as day, but you're not hearing anything at all. That's got to be one of the more troubling things.
I know when my mom told me that account, that was the thing that struck me, is she couldn't hear it. Not the noise of a jet engine, not the noise of propellers. The other thing I should mention about those, to try to add a little more to the believer side, is that several of these witnesses were World War II veterans and have seen, and one witness, as I recall, worked on a base with planes, and he clearly identified it as a bomber called a Lancaster. And he said he would know the difference between a Lancaster and, let's say, a modern prop plane like a C-130, of which England does have a few of their version of that plane in their arsenal. But he claimed to be able to tell the difference. So,
wow. It would be quite a sight to see something of that nature. And when you see something like that, that's just even more irrefutable than just, I saw a shadow or I saw this. It's like, I saw a tank down the road, or I saw a plane right there, clear as day.
Right.
That wraps up part two of the Grave Talks. A big thank you to Matthew Swaney for joining us for the episode today. Very compelling conversation. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for supporting us and keeping us on the air.